And so I called this lesson, The Lord and His Servants. There are a lot of wonderful servants in this church. A lot of people who serve and do a lot of good things that I don't even know that's going on. And that's just fine that I don't. But even when, the more I hear what people are doing, the more I'm always impressed with what people are doing individually in this group. God has a lot of servants. And a lot of them show up in this book. First of all, a servant is a person who works for a master to achieve the ends that that master has in mind, to achieve his purposes. God is the master, and He takes people and He employs them as His servants to achieve His purposes. And our job is to fit into His service. Now, those servants that God uses, I've learned as I've read through Isaiah, may be good and they may be bad. They may be willing people and they may be very unwilling people. And I listed a few of these servants that show up in the book of Isaiah. Isaiah himself was a servant. Eliakim was another person called the servant of the Lord. Hezekiah was the Lord's servant. Sennacherib of Assyria was the Lord's servant. Nebuchadnezzar of Babylon was the Lord's servant. Jeremiah calls him that. Cyrus of Persia was the Lord's servant. And then there was also the unnamed servant in the book of Isaiah. I can't talk about all of those, so I just picked four that I want us to spend a few minutes on to think about these different servants that show up in this book. But I think there's some good lessons that come from each one of them. And the first one I decided to pick this morning for us to think about is Isaiah. And I'm going to call him the willing servant. And in chapter 6 is where we really first meet him as a person. And his most famous statement in Isaiah, in the book, is, "Here am I, send me." That's a powerful statement, isn't it? "Here am I, send me." God was looking for a volunteer to send to the people of Judah to tell them about the condition they were in and try his best to get them to turn away from that their rebelliousness. And but he says, "Who's going to go?" And Isaiah raises his hand and says, "Here am I, send me." And I thought, what was wrong with that man? I mean, that was shocking to me when you read about those people that he volunteered himself, because they were really rebellious. And when God told him what his mission was, he basically said, nobody is going to repent. I mean, it was like a zero chance of a success rate, is the way that we would define success. Not the way God defines it, the way we define it. And so, why in the world would a man volunteer for a mission like that? But then when you read through those first verses, the first seven verses that precede when he said, "Here am I, send me," you kind of understand why. So if you look at chapter 6, if you've got your Bibles open and look there, you'll kind of see what happened. It says, when King Uzziah died, Isaiah says, "I saw the Lord sitting on a throne, lofty and exalted, with the train of His robe filling the temple." He got a picture of the Lord. He got to see the Lord in the temple. And all he could see, I guess, was the train of His robe. It doesn't seem like he ever gets above the hem of the robe. But it filled the entire temple. So you imagine standing in his position. Try to imagine that. And not only was the Lord there, but these seraphim, these spiritual creatures, stood with him. And they had six wings, and two covered their faces, and two they covered their feet, and with two they flew. And they start calling out one to another these words, "Holy, holy, holy is the Lord of hosts. The whole earth is full of His glory." And the foundations and the thresholds of the temple begin to shake, and the whole room starts filling with smoke. And you're standing there. You're standing there and visualizing this. And the response of this man was, as he looked on the Lord, this glorious, powerful Lord, he said, "Woe is me, for I am ruined, because I'm a man of unclean lips, and I live among a people of unclean lips. For I have seen, my eyes have seen the Lord of hosts, the King of glory." When he was confronted with the Lord himself, that really caused him to see himself for what he really was. And Isaiah was a good man. He was not one of the rebels of this nation. But when he looked at the Lord and he saw himself in view of him, he saw himself different than he had ever seen himself before. But God responded to that. It said one of those seraphim flew to him and took a burning coal, this is verse 6, from the altar, and he touched Isaiah's mouth with it. And he said, this has touched your lips, and your iniquity has been taken away, and your sin is forgiven. He sees the Lord. He sees himself as a sinner and that he is ruined. And he confesses his sinfulness, and then God heals him and forgives him of those sins. And then only after that experience, when God says, now, who am I going to send to tell all these other people about me and the condition that they are in and my grace that I would like to extend to them? That's when Isaiah says in verse 8, he hears of the Lord, he says, here am I, send me. You know, people. What we have here is a good example that we are not forgiven just to enjoy forgiveness. Sometimes we're baptized and then we just become stagnant. But we are baptized and forgiven in order to serve. We're forgiven in order to become servants of the Lord, so He can use us for His purposes. And Isaiah said, "Here am I, send me." He was ready to do something. And what's interesting is he had no idea what he was going to do. He volunteered before he knew what the mission was. But you know what? When a person is properly terrified by God's holiness, and he was terrified when he saw the Lord, and properly motivated by God's grace as he was forgiven for his sins, then that person is ready to do God's bidding, no matter how difficult the work. He doesn't ask what it is, doesn't ask where he has to go. He just says, in view of what he's done for me and who he is, just here I am and use me for your service. That's a great statement, I think, of a servant that Isaiah used. You know, some people are motivated for the wrong reasons to go and be servants of the Lord. People are motivated to say, here am I, send me, and go do things by coercion. People put the pressure on them. People force them out to go. That's not how the Lord did to get people to go and tell people. When you ask what motivated Isaiah to go and assume this task that was so difficult, he was motivated by what he saw that day in the temple. He saw the holiness of God, and he saw the love of God and the grace of God that was expressed to him. And that motivated him. A person that is horrified by his own sin, and Isaiah was, and healed by God's grace, does not need to be coerced. He just needs opportunity. And that ought to be the motive behind each of us when we go out into the world and we talk to our friends. We're going to talk to them not because somebody at the church is beating us down with a stick, because somebody's trying to coerce us and tell us this is what we have to do, but because we've been motivated by the love of God and what He's extended to us. And that ought to be enough to push us or encourage us to go and help others. Well, that's the willing servant, and Isaiah was willing. Here's the second man that I chose, and that was Hezekiah. He was what I'm going to call the unlikely servant. He is the unlikely servant. And the reason I say he is the unlikely servant, and before I say, why don't you turn to 2 Kings chapter 18. That's the passage where we learn about Hezekiah's beginnings when he first was given the role of being a king over Judah. And the reason I call him an unlikely servant is what's said about him in the first verse. Now it came about, this is 2 Kings chapter 18 and verse 1, in the third year of Hoshea, the son of Elah, who was a king in Israel. That was the northern kingdom, and Isaiah's in the southern kingdom. That Hezekiah, the son of Ahaz, king of Judah, became king. Well, the reason he is the most unlikely person to become a good servant of the Lord is because he had a bad father. His father was horrible. It's very hard to do just the opposite of what you've seen done around your house when you're growing up. It's very hard not to imitate your parents. if they were people who should not have been imitated. Their ways kind of become your default mechanism. Kind of fall back on that. It's just what you learn by 18 or 20 years or however long you're in their household. You may not even want to learn it, but you learn it because that's where you were. Ahaz was very wicked. Hezekiah may have seen his brothers burned as sacrifices. That's one of Ahaz's outstanding qualities. Idolater. And sacrifice some of his children to the gods. He didn't trust in the Lord. Ahaz didn't. He was not a man who depended on God. When Assyria, who was their rival nation that was on the rise, started moving to the west and approaching there, Ahaz, instead of listening to the voice of Isaiah, who was saying, just trust in the Lord. Just trust in God. He can take care of these guys. God even said, I will give you a sign. You just name it. I'll give you any sign you want. And Ahaz says, no, don't want that. Kind of showed some false piety. And God gave him a sign anyway. A sign of a virgin woman, a maiden who would give birth to a son. And before that son was old enough to do good or bad, the nations that were threatening him would just be wiped out. And Ahaz says, I don't want any sign. But instead, what he did was he made an alliance with Assyria. He joined forces. He paid. He sent money to the Assyrian nation to pay them not to come and bother him, to stay away. And it worked for a while. It worked for a number of years. They listened to him. He was self-reliant and self-dependent. And fathers have a powerful influence on their children, don't they? And here's Hezekiah growing up in that household under the influence of Ahaz. There's only one way I can imagine that Hezekiah could resist the temptation to follow his father's path. He must have had a good mother. And the Chronicle writer mentions that his mother here in this verse, verse 2, he says he was 25 years old when he became king. He reigned 29 years in Jerusalem, and his mother's name was Abby, the daughter of Zechariah. Chronicles calls her Abijah. I thought that was a man's name. That's what they call her, Abijah. And some have suggested that maybe he was a priest, maybe a good priest. We thank God for the influence of mothers. I think most of us probably do that here. And one Roman emperor said that the hand that rocks the cradle rules the world. And perhaps Hezekiah's rule was shaped by his mother more than it was his father. I don't know that for sure, but he was born to a wicked father. He was an unlikely candidate to be a real good servant of the Lord. But in spite of that, he was good, in spite of his father's bad influence. Verse 3 is just a couple of little verses that are a commentary on what God thought about him. It says, he did right in the sight of the Lord according to all his father David had done. If you drop down again in verse 5, start there. He says, he trusted in the Lord, the God of Israel, so that after him there was none like him among all the kings of Judah, nor among those who were before him. He clung to the Lord. He did not depart from following him, but kept his commandments, which the Lord had commanded Moses. I think he's an unlikely candidate, but what it taught me is that you can be a follower of the Lord. You can be a servant of the Lord and do what is right, in spite of maybe your background, maybe some dark, shadowy influence in the past. You can still do what is right. Hezekiah chose to do that. He did a lot of things. Verse 4 just names several of those things. He reformed the nation. A nation that was... He was handed a very hard task. You think that Obama was handed a hard task. I mean, he was handed a hard, difficult task to deal with. He had a nation that was completely corrupt, had followed his father. But Hezekiah, verse 4, says he removed the high places, he broke down the sacred pillars, he cut down the Asherah, he broke in pieces the bronze serpent that Moses had made, for unto those days the sons of Israel had burned incense to it. So he reformed the nation, he refurbishes the temple, another text tells us. He reinstituted the Passover that had been gone into neglect. He invited the Israelites from the northern kingdom to come down and celebrate the Passover with them, and some of them even took him up on it. He did a lot of good things in effort to reform the nation and bring them back to the Lord, because he knew that God was angry because of the idolatry. He was really faithful for 29 years. He was a faithful king. But he wasn't perfect. He wasn't perfect. He had an imperfect faith. And there was a time when the Assyrians, as they approached Jerusalem, were at Lachish, a nearby city, as you've learned as we're studying on Wednesday night. Even though he had rebelled against this Assyrian king not too many years before, now he's afraid because he's just outside the door. And when that king turned his attention to Judah and began burning the cities down, Hezekiah did what we do sometimes. Instead of turning to the Lord, he sort of he fell back by default into the things that his father did. And so you might read a few verses just in chapter 18, same chapter, down in verse 14. It says, Hezekiah the king of Judah sent to the king of Assyria at Lachish. He's just in the next town over. He said, I've done wrong. Withdraw from me. Whatever you impose on me, I will bear. So the king of Assyria required Hezekiah the king of Judah 300 talents of silver and 30 talents of gold. Hezekiah gave him all the silver which he found in the house of the Lord and in the treasuries of the king's house. And at that time, Hezekiah cut off the gold from the doors of the temple of the Lord and from the doorposts which Hezekiah the king of Judah had overlaid, and he gave it to the king of Assyria. You know, again, it's really hard not to do what your parents might do. It's kind of a default mechanism in the time of crisis to do what you've seen done in the past. And so Hezekiah tries to pay off the king. He thought, well, it worked for Dad. Maybe it'll work for me. Didn't work. Didn't work. Took his gold, took his silver. He said, I'm coming anyway. Showed up right outside the gates. And so what did he do? Well, fortunately for Hezekiah, he made a different decision than his father made. Under that, after he had tried his methods and his tactics, and he had tried to trust in his own wisdom and maybe his father's wisdom, he decided instead he turned back to the Lord. And that's where he gains the credibility of faith, is that he turned back to God. Yeah, his back was against the wall. That's true. But you know, he wanted to trust in God. And he made that decision and God accepted that. And so when you look down in verse 19 and 20 of that chapter, as this general approaches him and starts threatening him and questions his confidence, Hezekiah turns to the Lord and he prays to him, and the Lord says, I have heard your prayer. I've heard your prayer. And that's the story of Hezekiah. He was an unlikely servant of God. But he chose to go against, to do the opposite, maybe, of what the path that his dad chose. He chose to serve the Lord. He chose to put his confidence in Him. He didn't do it perfectly all the time, but he kept turning back. And the Lord honored that. And when He gave him, when He wrote this biography of Hezekiah, when He puts it in and boils it all down to a single couple of phrases, He says about him that he clung to the Lord, for he did not depart from following Him. That means he never failed, but he kept turning back. He kept putting his faith in Him. And that's what God's looking for. So Hezekiah was the unlikely servant. I like him. He's another character that played a role in this book that served as one of the servants of the Lord. But there's another fellow that I want you to meet. His name is Sennacherib. I'm going to call him the tyrannical servant. And I call him that because that's just exactly what he was. His story begins sort of in chapter 10 of Isaiah. He had power. He had resources. He had an insatiable appetite for self-glory. And so he had moved across the country conquering and overwhelming people and taking advantage of people. And Israel made the bad mistake, under Ahaz anyway, with forming an alliance with him. They tried to trust him, entrusted themselves to this man. They entrusted themselves to a tyrant rather than trusting in the Lord. And as I read about that, it occurred to me that God uses the things we trust in sometimes to punish us. Chapter 10 there and verse 5, if you turn over there, Isaiah, this is Isaiah chapter 10 and verse 5. It says, woe to Assyria, the rod of my anger, and the staff in whose hands is my indignation. I send it against a godless nation. God sort of employs Sennacherib. Sennacherib thinks he's his own self, that he's his own boss. He's driving himself. But really, God's behind this. He says, I'm choosing him as my... He's kind of like the whipping stick. He's God, the way God's going to... the instrument God's going to use to spank Judah. And he sent him to wake him up. And I think it's very hard for us. Hard to understand how God can do that. How can God use such a person as his servant? I mean, so what he did, he served God's purpose to discipline Judah. You know, a master owns his servants, and he has a right by virtue of ownership to use them as he wishes. And he even used this wicked man. But I want you to notice his motive real quick. Look down in verse 20. After he speaks about this one who he's going to use as a instrument of his wrath against Judah to punish them for their unfaithfulness, he says in verse 20, "It will come about in that day that the remnant of Israel and those of the house of Jacob who have escaped will never again rely on the one who struck them, but will truly rely on the Lord, the Holy One of Israel." I want you to focus on God's motive. What was his purpose of using this man? He was wicked, by all accounts. But God saw it as a method by which he could cause his people to turn away from relying on the world and their own wisdom and turn back and trust in him. And so, you know, his motive is always to save us. You need to see that. That's important. God will employ, you know, wicked servants sometimes to achieve his end. But his end is always good. His motive is to cause us to turn back to him and to save us. Jerusalem, I want to show, or Sennacherib showed up at Jerusalem's door. He comes to the door and he has a pretty overwhelming army, 185,000 soldiers. Maybe more. And he's standing outside the gates, and he's somebody compared Sennacherib one time to Jerusalem to a vulnerable maiden before a swaggering rapist. And here is Sennacherib, and he's there, and he's wanting to invade them and take them and use them and take advantage of them. You know what happened at that point? If you turn over to chapter 37, this is where our story from earlier about Hezekiah picks up. Because Hezekiah in chapter 37 and verse 14, he prayed. And in verse 14 it says, "Hezekiah took the letter from the hand of the messengers and he read it." The messengers from the Assyrian king who was saying, "I'm about to wipe you out and invade your city." He said, "He went up to the house of the Lord and spread it before the Lord. And Hezekiah prayed to the Lord and said, O Lord of hosts," this is verse 16, "the God of Israel who is enthroned above the cherubim, thou art the God, thou alone of all the kingdoms of the earth. You've made heaven and earth. Listen, incline your ear, O Lord, and hear. Open your eyes, O Lord, and see and listen to all the words of Sennacherib, who sent them to reproach the living God. Truly, O Lord, the kings of Assyria have devastated all the countries and their lands, have cast their gods into the fire. They were not gods, but the work of men's hands, wood and stone. They've destroyed them. And now, O Lord, deliver us from his hand, that all the kingdoms of the earth may know that thou alone art God." And so Isaiah the son of Amoz sent word to Hezekiah and said, "Thus saith the Lord, the God of Israel, because you have prayed to me about Sennacherib, the king of Assyria." He said, "Because you have prayed, here's what I'm going to do." Well, things changed for Judah when somebody turned to him, to the Lord, and prayed to him. And the response that God gave him was down... I'll just read two verses here. Verse 33 and through 35. That's three verses. "Therefore thus saith the Lord concerning the king of Assyria, he shall not come to this city. He will not shoot an arrow there. Neither shall he come before it with a shield, nor throw up a mound against it. By the way he came, the same he shall return. And he shall not come to this city, declares the Lord. For I will defend this city and save it for my own sake and for the sake of my servant David." And so God's response to that prayer was, "He will never touch you. He will never even shoot the first arrow into your city." And sure enough, maybe not as quickly as Hezekiah wanted to happen, but Sennacherib left, and 20 years later he was murdered in his own temple. His God was not even strong enough to save him in his own temple. But God delivered. Use that servant though he was wicked and a tyrant, to cause his people to come back to him and to trust in him instead of themselves. And God ought to be praised for his graciousness in those particular cases. But one last example. There's other ones too. We could talk about Nebuchadnezzar or Cyrus, the king of Persia. Those are also men who God used in his service as servants to accomplish his purpose. But the last one is the unnamed servant. We know who he is, but they didn't. Isaiah chapter 53, if you want to look over there, we'll spend just a minute looking at that. In the first century, the Jews didn't recognize him. They didn't know who this was in Isaiah 53. Isaiah never gave him a name. And back in the days of Isaiah, the people then didn't know who he was. They were probably more zeroed in on passages like this, the passages about this glorious king that God was going to send. In chapter 9, verse 6 and 7, he said, there'll be one who will come, a son will be born to us, who will be called Wonderful Counselor, Mighty God, Eternal Father, Prince of Peace. That's what they were looking at. They said, wow, that's the one we want. And so they spent a lot of time and energy looking for that king, and nobody was showing up. Maybe Hezekiah is him. But Hezekiah didn't last. Hezekiah died too, and he wasn't perfect. So who is this guy? And you might imagine being a Jew in that day, and you're sitting in exile in Babylon, and you're saying, where's this king? Where's that king that God said he was going to send, that was going to be a wonderful counselor and a mighty God and was going to deliver us? Where is he? And the Jews in the first century were looking for that too. What they didn't understand was that same king reappeared in the second part of the book as a servant. And so if you look over to Isaiah 53, that's the place that really struck them as strange. They couldn't figure out who this was. But a servant began to be appearing in the second part of this book, chapter 42 and 49 and chapter 50 and chapter 52. And he's somebody different, very different. And this servant, a little bit more is revealed about him every chapter until you get to chapter 53 and verse 4. And here's what it says about this servant that God was going to send. Surely our griefs he himself bore, and our sorrows he carried. And yet we ourselves esteemed him stricken, smitten of God, and afflicted. But he was pierced through for our transgressions, and he was crushed for our iniquities. The chastening for our well-being fell upon him. By his scourging we are healed. All of us like sheep have gone astray. Each of us has turned to his own way. But the Lord has caused the iniquity of us all to fall on him. This servant had the role like no other. This servant took our whipping. That's what he was sent to do. We're the ones who sin. And he's the one who suffered. And we learn from his death. We learn from his death that God hates sin because he had to punish sin. That servant suffered because our sins brought us into conflict with the Lord. But we see God turning away his anger in the book of Isaiah. That's some other interesting passages that these Jews couldn't quite figure. They were condemned as rebellious. But then as you go through the book of Isaiah, you find that somehow, God turned away his wrath. Chapter 12 and verse 1. Then you will say on that day, I will give thanks to the Lord, O God, for although thou wast angry with me, thine anger is turned away, and thou dost comfort me. How did he do that? Why would God turn his anger away from such wicked and rebellious people? Chapter 51 and verse 21. He had given them this cup of his wrath to drink because of their sins. But then in verse 21 it says, therefore, please hear this, you afflicted, you who are drunk, but not with wine. Thus says the Lord even your God, who contends for his people. Behold, I've taken out of your hand the cup of reeling, the chalice of my anger. You will never drink it again. How did he do that? How did God take that cup of anger out of their hands that they should have drank because of their sin? Because he made his son drink the cup for them. Because he made his son drink that cup in our place. you know, as we stop and think just for a second about his affliction, about Jesus being afflicted for us, about receiving our chastening, for receiving our scourging, our piercing, we need to ask the question, what should we do in return for him? What's our obligation in view of what he did for us? He sent a servant. It's not like these other servants that we talked about today. This one was a different kind of servant. He was one that sacrificed himself for us, for all man. How should we respond to that love? I want to suggest to you that we need to love him back. We got to love him in return. Paul said in 2 Corinthians chapter 5, in verse 14, the love of Christ compels us. It controls us. His great love for me ought to cause me to love him back in return. We need to meditate on this sacrifice so much more. We don't meditate on it enough. Sometimes it's a story that we've read so many times that we read it with contempt. We don't think about it. We don't sit and focus on it like we should. Jesus choosing that role of a servant when he had, you know, all the glory and all the riches of heaven, he had everything going for him. He had no reason, personal motive to come here whatsoever. It was all for loss. I mean, it was all going to work against him to come here. He had nothing to gain in this life here by being here. We need to think about that. How he came here for us, for our benefit, not for himself. Or maybe we need to think more about his Father who gave up his Son for us. It needs to move us. It needs to control us. It needs to drive our spirits the way that we behave. And his love for us should also determine how we love others. That he loved us, and therefore we ought to love others in the same way. You know, we don't deserve his love. Sometimes we have to love people that we don't care about. They don't deserve our love. They did something that against us. They hurt us. They don't deserve it. Well, I don't deserve his love either. But he did something for me. He sent his Son here to die for me. And I can put myself down in order to lift others up, just like he did for me. And I can put others ahead of me, just like he put my interests ahead of his own interests. You know, so many times it's me first. I think about me when I ought to think about somebody else. The apostles struggle with that. You know, they struggled so much. How many times did he catch them arguing about who's the greatest? How many times did he catch them in that discussion? And he had to straighten them out. You can't be a part of this kingdom when you are in first place. You're supposed to take last place. You're supposed to be the servant. You know, I didn't come here to be servant. I came to serve and give my life as a ransom for many. You got to do the same thing. It took his apostles. You know, they didn't learn that until he was on the cross. And it was not until after the crucifixion that really seemed to come home to them. We need to focus on that death more and think about his sacrifice so that we might come to think about the interests of others ahead of our own. When we were baptized, we signed up for the role of a servant. Did you know that? If you haven't been baptized, it is for forgiveness. That's the purpose that God gave. We need to be forgiven. But once again, we aren't forgiven in order to enjoy forgiveness, but we're forgiven in order to serve God. You signed up to be a selfless servant. And I'm learning that I don't even understand the extent to which that's demanded of me yet. If I don't do that at home, if I don't do that here for you, then how will I be prepared if I'm asked to give my own life like he was asked to do on the cross? It is a daily sacrifice. It is a daily taking up my cross and learn what it means to follow him, to serve others. That's what God's looking for. This morning, take your songbooks out. The passage that I had read at the beginning of the lesson presented this idea of two different kinds of servants, two different kinds of vessels that God will use. He said, God knows those who are his. He knows those who are his. He said, we have a choice. We either be a vessel of honor or a vessel of dishonor. We either be one who is a servant that God, who gives himself into the service of the Lord, and he will take us and use us for whatever purpose he has, whatever things that he needs to accomplish through us. Or we can choose to be one of these other servants, a wicked servant, another vessel. But He'll still use us. He'll use us to achieve His purposes. We need to make a choice today on what kind of servant we will be. And make that choice now and respond to that invitation to believe in Jesus and be baptized for the forgiveness of your sins as together we stand and sing.